today she's going to be talking about this project, and again I think it was Ricardo who brought it to our attention, of this unmade film, this unrealized film, this project for a film called Women. So I will hand you over to Esther.
Thank you. My piece is maybe a little more speculative, and in the first half I wanted to look at some issues pertinent to SHUB that relate to things already said, and then in the second half we'll look in a little more detail at the project Women, perhaps in relation to those things. It's hard to see Esfeh SHUB, and not just in terms of her relative invisibility until now in film programming and in critical discussion, but rather because of her authorial anonymity, her use of found footage, grainy secondhand materials, gathered strips made by nameless filmers. SHUB was an editor of films, or perhaps someone whose labour on film did not even have a name, for she was not simply an editor in the way that many other women especially were, in terms of their job description, engaged in sorting shots, cutting the negative, but not even making the rough cut of the film. In her work, she did something else. Her editing work for the Soviet film industry from 1922, re-editing, retitling foreign films, such as Fritz Lang's Dr. Mabuse, Der Spieler, or trashy American serials, so that they might become ideologically correct, involved more than just being an editor. Hers was a key cultural role. In 1924, for example, over 90% of films shown were produced in capitalist countries. In these years of the new economic policy, many films were imported. SHUB worked on a politically and economically viable solution to a materials crisis. And she learned how to montage films, producing new meanings from old stock, rechanneling ruling class ideology. She carried this experience over into her own practice as filmmaker. Her film, The Fall of the Romanov Dynasty, made in 1927 and part of a trilogy on Russian history from 1896, when Lumiere filmed the coronation of Tsar Nicholas II, was one of several films made to celebrate the 10th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. It's said that the Soviet film body Sovkino initially refused to acknowledge her authorial rights and paid the royalties that would duly accrue. She's credited on the poster as follows: work by E.I. SHUB. What was that work? SHUB's film reconstructed critical history out of many meters of newsreel footage and Romanov home movies. Documentary film of whatever type, news, scientific, or industrial footage, home movies, it could all yield information about reality. SHUB's so-called compilation film showed the Tsar and family at their summer home and on duties of state, the carnage of war, and Lenin agitating. For this film and for the other two compilation films she made in the late 1920s, SHUB had to amass materials that had in many cases been taken out of the country, sold to foreign producers, or deteriorated under poor storage conditions. For her film covering the first 10 years after the October Revolution, responding to the monotony of much film produced in newsreels in those years, parades, official celebrations, meetings, delegates arriving, all stock that evades the drama of political reconstruction, she shot her own images of old documents, photographs, newspapers, and objects. That this work was only, or was blandly, work is the problem attendant on working outside an authorial directorial mode. But there is, of course, a perfect meeting of SHUB's reuse of found footage, her labour or arrangement or compilation of something conceived as raw material, meeting then with the ideas prevalent amongst the circles of the left front of arts, the avant-gardist and pro-revolutionary groupings that had surfed the ecstasies of revolution and clamoured for a role in state building through the arts. For they argued that the author was a producer, or more, the author should be effaced in the collective labour of socially and technically produced and reproduced works of culture. Shubb, more than any other, knew what it meant to be anonymous, to genuinely work within the model of the collective. Author, the author as producer, the author who rejects all the bourgeois baloney of creativity, genius, and originality. Her more famous colleague Eisenstein had paid lip service to this in a polemic against Bela Balázs. His terminology, Eisenstein writes, is unpleasant, different from ours, art, creativity, eternity, greatness, and so on. Eisenstein, for his part, broke with the grouping around the left front of arts in March 1929, precisely over questions of personal style and authorship. Eisenstein, it was said, was too much the artist. Eisenstein placed too much of himself in the film. Eisenstein made his films about Eisenstein's eye and sense of things. As proof of this stood, apparently, Eisenstein's celebration as a filmmaker in Europe and the fact that US studios sought him out, keen to import a little higher art into their venues. But Shubb's work did something more than articulate the anonymous collectivized art worker or engineer, and in so doing sent into relief the practices of another more prominent documentarist, Ziga Vertov. Shubb's approach signaled a new approach to documentary, overturning the highly montaged, artistic, formalistic documentary films of the early period, as practiced by Vertov. Vertov had himself worked with found footage in 1918, for example, in his anniversary of the revolution, and in 1921 in his history of the Civil War. But he largely moved away from the practice. Shubb objected to Vertov's efforts to monopolize non-fiction film, insisting in a piece written in 1926 that different facts must reach the studio, not just those endorsed by the futurists working within Vertov's Kinox or Cine-Eye. Vertov deployed all manner of tricks and technical devices derived from the fragmented and dynamic worldview of futurism in order to emphasize cinema's role in mediating reality. Shubb's archival work rescued fact from oblivion and made it speak again in a new context and not to questions of cinematic self-reflection. In her use of archival and documentary footage, or what she called authentic material, Shubb displayed her commitment to the fact that had become a fetish amongst the left people, who spoke of their work in terms of documentarism or factography. The later 1920s, perhaps under the pressure of waning revolutionary dynamism and consciousness of questions of state building, seemed to demand a new aesthetic, which was then matched by Shubb. Shubb's was seen as the cinema of fact. What is a cinematic fact? This was a question that was asked and answered in relation to Shubb's projects. It was a debate that took place in the pages of the journal Novi Lev, where one contributor, Zezhai Tretyakov, opined that the degree of the deformation of the material out of which film is composed was tantamount to the random personal factor in any given film. The raw material, the facts that are absorbed by the celluloid strip of the camera, should come before the eyes of the audience as undeformed as possible. The cinematic fact was to appear in as undistorted a form as possible. Such a fact is seen to be a building block of a new reality that needed stability after the dynamic change of revolution. Such a fact is like a weapon in the hands of a party entrenching its power and desirous of conveying the upward soaring truth of the young Soviet Union. Shubb, it is true, avoided playing with the filmic material, tending often to let chunks of found film run their course. She gave time to her material, but not simply so. There was a sense, though, in her work that the film material was of historical interest in itself and did not need to be undercut and criticised through cinematic devices. The commitment to the fact did not imply that any other questions of film were irrelevant. Schuber's editor worked on questions of compilation, which were questions of montage and rhythm. Connections between events and their interpretation were expressed through juxtapositions, as well as through the times attributed by editing, and also through intertitles. The whole builds. The whole has direction and argument that can be seen and borne in mind. It becomes essayistic. She wrote that her own emphasis on the fact is an emphasis not only to show the fact, but to enable it to be examined and, having examined it, to be kept in mind. To watch a film by Schub was to watch reality pass by, moulded, made into concept and argument, a comprehensible concept and argument. Schub is not averse to arguments about skills, and even the rhetoric of masterliness in the face of facts. Indeed, in 1927, she titled an article, "We Do Not Reject the Element of Mastery." The facts, like any raw material, need processing and shaping. In 1927, she argued in the journal Novyelev that the controversy between staged and unstaged film was the basic issue of contemporary cinema. Only documentary cinema could express reality. And she writes, "With great mastery, it is possible to make a film from non-played material that is better than any fiction film." The polemic was printed. Schub criticised Eisenstein's October as a distortion of history because of its restaging of the historical events of the Russian Revolution. Eisenstein had watched Schub as she worked in the early days, and he'd learnt from her, developing film aesthetics to adequately convey revolutions, reorganisations, its swift changes, its rearticulation of modes of thought and life. She learnt from him too, and they led discussions in letters in 1931 over the necessity of, quote, "developing one's concept of reality in the process of shooting and only then subordinating the material to the director's vision." But Eisenstein stuck with the played film. Schub was particularly affronted by an actor's impersonation of Lenin. Why let someone pretend to be Lenin when there is archive footage of the real Lenin? Schub placed film's power in its capturing of what she called the small fragment of the life that has really passed, whatever elements it contained. Whatever elements it contains, and even if it was itself just a fiction or a slice of ideology or contaminated by anti-revolutionary values, the ideological circumstances that had produced much of the material did not adhere to the film pieces once they were redeployed in a new context. Ideology could be respun or overturned. The film's returns revolutionised them. Revolution is a spin, a respin, but not one that repeats, or if it does, it's a sign of its failure. A revolution involves another spin, a revolving, an activation into something else, which is movement, a rapid turn and overturning or upturning. Just as the camera turns, spins the exposing film and makes something new happen, the imprinting of an out there on the in there of the film strip. Just as the projector turns, revolves, spins the filmed things through its mechanism in order for them to take on their ghost life, their shadowy and light existence on the screen, something new happens. The film exists out there on the screen and is seen. Schub understood that film's essence lay in its spinning and re-spinning. She wrote, "The intention was not so much to provide the facts, but to evaluate them from the vantage point of the revolutionary class. This is what made my films revolutionary and agitational, although they were composed of counter-revolutionary material." Schub's work takes the fact and deploys it skillfully. Her work is planned, and that, of course, at a time when plans are becoming more the focus of political rhetoric and energy. Shubb's relationship to the archive, the place of her raw material, might invent parallels with a bureaucratic approach, congruent with the times, examining the files of reality for evidence, sorting and classifying it for further eyes to pore over, making new meanings of it. The left circle recognised her abnegating act of editing. She also carried out the work of organising the archive, thereby bequeathing a raw material to those who came after, to all the other films that could be made from it, all the other meanings that might be extracted from this raw material of the real. That was a further service to multiple authorship. One film that was planned in 1933-4 was to be titled Women. Conceived of in seven parts, it was to be about the recent history of female oppression and consequent female liberation by the Bolsheviks. Women were to be shown through filmic found footage and scripted constructed situations, moving from sexual objectification or object of sexual objectification and class oppression to politically engaged subjects. Shubb's work in this period brings together the proximity of document, of the unplayed, and the artistically shaping, planning, structuring, or mastering aspects in relation to the filmic elements. Shubb wrote of the project in a 1933 article titled, I Want to Make a Film About Women. I quote, "Hitherto, it was considered that the non-staged film lacked the possibility of developing events dramatically and that it could not sustain a plot construction within itself. That is why the documentary film was never appreciated by the large audiences. I'm aware of this, and in my new documentary film, I will try to construct a thematic line. This does not mean that I need to follow the established canons of the staged cinema, nor that I have to use actors to impersonate my characters. Life is so complex and contradictory in everyday situations that it continuously creates dramatic conflicts and resolves them unexpectedly in the most extraordinary way. No one need play anyone who they are not in the film. Reality itself is dramatic enough and contradictory enough to generate stories, dramas of the type invented for the played film. For Shubb, life itself usurps the dramatic function of fiction. Effectively, the artistic documentary that she is to make and call Women can stage the unstaged, can make an art of the document. The film script begins with excerpts from the art of the imperial period. Animation segues a mother into a nude woman, into a Beardsley-style siren. Shubb talks of Madonnas, Gretas, Susans, created by world-famous artists. Then cinema intervenes. Old film footage is replayed, showing women as Madonnas or whores. One French film heroine is showed in her role as a Madonna, then as a fairy. She mutates into other Russian starlets who emulate her. A woman with child in arms appears and morphs into a prostitute, then a peasant. A parade of women appear, all backed by circus music. The exhortation then turns to the men of the actual audience. Gentlemen, do you still want to enjoy the face of the ideal woman of the 20th century? If so, buy the gramophone records. Watch the films produced by Pathé. Tragic film incidents then from fictional cinema flash up. Shots, strangulations, alienation. Oh my God, states a woman in a melodrama. What shall I do? The fiction of unreal women in the movies is brought to the point of real intervention into the world. Shubb's screenplay picks up the question. Indeed, she has to do something. Shubb has provided in a rapid montage a selection of limited stereotypes of women. a comment in the script notes, "The movie theatres of Imperial Russia depicted the Russian woman always in the same manner. Then we're shown it, often fainting into the arms of a man. The words continue to echo. Oh my God, what shall I do? What shall I do?" These scenes are followed by more examples of how women have been positioned as fashionable creatures, as targets of advertising concerned about their busts, their waists, this season's belts, as seductresses. Women dependent economically on men, husbands, lovers. "What is this sphinx of woman?" asks Shub. This is the ideality of woman as depicted in the movies, a beauty, sometimes powerful, usually vulnerable, but in a beautiful way. This intensity of ideological images is then interrupted by a clown falling through a ceiling, hitting his wife with a rolling pin, such that everything freezes. The audience shouts, "Bravo." The scene of violence against women, the nasty heart of entertainment, serves as a transition. After this, silence comes and darkness. That was the old cinema. The darkness lifts and we're all transported to the countryside. Here, everything is different. Cinema has its time, its distance, its day and its real sounds. Bells are ringing in the far distance. There's a village. There are old women and they go to church. A voice announces that we're at a cooperative farm. Instead of the ideological chit-chatter of films and advertising and religious song, there is the hum of the motor that speeds us through the space of collective labour. This car that moves us through a landscape is, we learn, a mobile sound movie theatre. It has come, we have come, to discover the reality of female life in the Soviet Union. Not just how it looks, how they, women, look, but how they sound too, for Shub is finding a way to achieve her dream of synced sound, which she discussed in 1929 in an article titled "The Arrival of Sound in Cinema." There she writes, "For us documentarists, it's crucial to learn how to record the authentic sound, noise, voices, etc., with the same degree of expressiveness as we learned how to photograph the authentic, non-staged reality. Therefore, we have little interest in what presently goes on in the film studios, in those hermetically insulated theatrical chambers dotted with microphones, sound intensifiers, and other techniques. We are interested in the experimental laboratories of the scientists and true creators, who can function as our sound operators." All are learning in this new authentic sound world. As the screenplay notes, we place our cameras in front of the window. We arrange the microphone and explain to Comrade Klyazin where he should stand in order for his voice to be heard as he asks his questions of the three sisters. This is a whole film, it would seem, or was to be a whole film, about voice, about speaking the self authentically. For we hear from Shub that the communist sisters are used to speaking at conferences and therefore talk briskly, while the religious one is more embarrassed. This sonic discrepancy, though, this mark of experience in voice and rhythm, will help us, she notes, to keep the conversation alive. We hear examples of the questions the sisters will be asked. The fascists claim that women must be involved only with the kitchen, the church, and children. Do you agree with this? Shub answers. We suspect that their answers will be keen and direct. To achieve this, Comrade Klyazin's questions must be spelled out in such a way that they reveal both the real life and psychology of a typical woman working in the Soviet village. If we succeed, it will be the first direct film interview with the new woman farmer in the USSR. Therefore, it has to be done in such a way that the conversation does not look contrived. All we can predict at this moment is that the interview will end with the words, "Now, would you take us to the Selsoviet?" As if as a nod to the role of staging in all this, the final scene of part one, which is all I've been able to read, takes place in the main offices of the Selsoviet, of the Rural Council. A girl is calling for a revolt, bored with life on the collective farm. Arguments are happening, but it transpires, it is a drama rehearsal, just a play for the collective's theatres in which the language and appearance of the youth who are urbanising and the traces of peasant language spoken by the collective, spoken on the collective farm, battle it out. This is a documentary, a capturing of fact that has been shaped by Shub's concepts, with elements that, in a sense, are imported from art in order to make ideological sense of the reality which otherwise enfolds. The situations are constructed, but there's something still, it almost reminds me in a way of something like The Only Way is Essex or something. You know, you produce the typicality of the situation, and there's a sort of authenticity and an inauthenticity at the same time. Improvisation can be improved upon in the name of a larger, greater improvement. Perhaps a negation of the negation is achieved through this. Film never stops being a document, even when it is most fictional, or especially then. The rotten cinema of Weimar, Hollywood, and Imperial Russia could have truth squeezed yet from them, if rightly framed. And so too can the film that moves between fact and staging. The document can supersede all, even the fiction film. Even the staged film is a document of something. And if it can be documented and its factographical powers unleashed in the interest of the larger history, which is one that is being built, planned, and constructed, then it will produce an authentic cinema. In 1932, Shub's film on the communist youth bed the means of the cinematic device by leaving cameras and microphones visible in scenes. But it also left in the stumbles and stutters of participants, or shined so bright an arc lamp into their eyes that their eyes screwed up. The materials of film and cinema directly confront the material of the collective body. The artifice of cinema leaves factual traces on the cinematic subjects. Shub exposed this. In the film script for women, she notes that the play in the Selsoviet represents a conflict between the urban appearance of the village Komsomol youngsters and the quasi-peasant language the author of the play forces his characters to talk. The fictionalizing author brutalizes reality, forces his characters to speak in the old language. This is a struggle in the play, just as it is a struggle in reality. The traces of the past that also have to be respun for new meanings to arise from them, new accents to develop out of them. This is what Shub wants to show. It's not that she finds a middle path between Vertov's Kinox and cinema of fact and Eisenstein's staged films. Rather, in confronting each mode openly with the other, she makes a third term, another thing, that amongst other things beats out a path for the essay films to come. So I'll finish there. Thank you.